Chapter 4 of The Benson Murder Case by S. S. Van Dyne. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for non-commercial purposes, as long as Legamus is credited and any new creation is licensed under the same terms. Read by Kathy Barrett. Chapter 4. The Housekeeper's Story. Friday, June 14, 11 a.m. "Now," suggested Markham, "suppose we take a look over the house. I imagine you've done that pretty thoroughly already, Sergeant, but I'd like to see the layout. Anyway, I don't want to question the housekeeper until the body has been removed." Heath rose. "Very good, sir. I'd like another look myself." The four of us went into the hall and walked down the passageway to the rear of the house. At the extreme end, on the left, was a door leading downstairs to the basement, but it was locked and bolted. "The basement is only used for storage now," Heath explained, "and the door which opens from it into the street areaway is boarded up. The Platts woman sleeps upstairs. Benson lived here alone, and there's plenty of spare room in the house, and the kitchen's on this floor." He opened a door on the opposite side of the passageway, and we stepped into a small, modern kitchen. Its two high windows, which gave into the paved rear yard at a height of about 8 feet from the ground, were securely guarded with iron bars, and in addition the sashes were closed and locked. Passing through a swinging door, we entered the dining-room, which was directly behind the living-room. The two windows here looked upon a small stone court, really no more than a deep air-well between Benson's house and the adjoining one, and these also were iron-barred and locked. We now re-entered the hallway and stood for a moment at the foot of the stairs leading above. "You can see, Mr. Markham," Heath pointed out, "that whoever shot Benson must have gotten in by the front door. There's no other way he could have entered. Living alone, I guess Benson was a little touchy on the subject of burglars. The only window that wasn't barred was the rear one in the living-room, and that was shut and locked. Anyway, it only leads into the inside court. The front windows of the living-room had that ironwork over them, so they couldn't have been used even to shoot through, for Benson was shot from the opposite direction. It's pretty clear the gunman got in the front door." "Looks that way," said Markham. "And pardon me for saying so," remarked Vance, "but Benson let him in." "Yes," retorted Heath unenthusiastically. "Well, we'll find all that out later, I hope." "Oh, doubtless," Vance dryly agreed. We ascended the stairs and entered Benson's bedroom, which was directly over the living room. It was severely but well furnished and in excellent order. The bed was made, showing it had not been slept in that night, and the window shades were drawn. Benson's dinner jacket and white piqué waistcoat were hanging over a chair. A winged collar and a black bow tie were on the bed, where they had evidently been thrown when Benson had taken them off on returning home. A pair of low evening shoes were standing by the bench at the foot of the bed. In a glass of water on the night table was a platinum plate of four false teeth, and a toupee of beautiful workmanship was lying on the chiffonnier. This last item aroused Vance's special interest. He walked up to it and regarded it closely. "Most interestin'," he commented. "Our departed friend seems to have worn false hair. Did you know that, Markham?" "I always suspected it," was the indifferent answer. Heath, who had remained standing on the threshold, seemed a little impatient. "There's only one other room on this floor," he said, leading the way down the hall. "It's also a bedroom, for guests, so the housekeeper explained." Markham and I looked in through the door, but Vance remained lounging against the balustrade at the head of the stairs. He was manifestly uninterested in Alvin Benson's domestic arrangements, and when Markham and Heath and I went up to the third floor, he sauntered down into the main hallway. When at length we descended from our tour of inspection, he was casually looking over the titles in Benson's bookcase. We had just reached the foot of the stairs when the front door opened and two men with a stretcher entered. The ambulance from the Department of Welfare had arrived to take the corpse to the morgue, and the brutal, businesslike way in which Benson's body was covered up, lifted onto the stretcher, carried out and shoved into the wagon, made me shudder. Vance, on the other hand, after the merest fleeting glance at the two men, paid no attention to them. He had found a volume with a beautiful Humphrey Milford binding, and was absorbed in its Roger Payne tooling and powdering. "I think an interview with Mrs. Platts is indicated now," said Markham, and Heath went to the foot of the stairs and gave a loud, brisk order. Presently a grey-haired, middle-aged woman entered the living-room accompanied by a plainsclothesman smoking a large cigar. Mrs. Platts was of the simple, old-fashioned, motherly type, with a calm, benevolent countenance. She impressed me as highly capable, and as a woman given little to hysteria, an impression strengthened by her attitude of passive resignation. She seemed, however, to possess that taciturn shrewdness that is so often found among the ignorant. "Sit down, Mrs. Platts," Markham greeted her kindly. "I'm the district attorney, and there are some questions I want to ask you." She took a straight chair by the door and waited, gazing nervously from one to the other of us. Markham's gentle, persuasive voice, though, appeared to encourage her, and her answers became more and more fluent. The main facts that transpired from a quarter of an hour's examination may be summed up as follows. Mrs. Platts had been Benson's housekeeper for 4 years, and was the only servant employed. She lived in the house, and her room was on the third or top floor in the rear. On the afternoon of the preceding day, Benson had returned from his office at an unusually early hour, around 4 o'clock, announcing to Mrs. Platts that he would not be home for dinner that evening. He had remained in the living room, with the hall door closed, until 6:30, and had then gone upstairs to dress. He had left the house about 7 o'clock, but had not said where he was going. He had remarked casually that he would return in fairly good season, but had told Mrs. Platts she need not wait up for him, which was her custom whenever he intended bringing guests home. This was the last she had seen him alive. She had not heard him when he returned that night. She had retired about 10:30, and because of the heat had left the door ajar. She had been awakened some time later by a loud detonation. It had startled her, and she had turned on the light by her bed, noting that it was just 12:30 by the small alarm clock she used for rising. It was, in fact, the early hour which had reassured her. Benson, whenever he went out for the evening, rarely returned home before 2, and this fact, coupled with the stillness of the house, had made her conclude that the noise which had aroused her had been merely the backfiring of an automobile in 49th Street. Consequently, she had dismissed the matter from her mind and gone back to sleep. At 7 o'clock the next morning, she came downstairs as usual to begin her day's duties, and on her way to the front door to bring in the milk and cream, had discovered Benson's body. All the shades in the living room were down. At first she thought Benson had fallen asleep in his chair, but when she saw the bullet hole and noticed that the electric lights had been switched off, she knew he was dead. She had gone at once to the telephone in the hall, and asking the operator for the police station, had reported the murder. She had then remembered Benson's brother, Major Anthony Benson, and had telephoned him also. He had arrived at the house almost simultaneously with the detectives from the West 47th Street station. He had questioned her a little, talked with the plainclothesman, and gone away before the men from headquarters arrived. "And now, Mrs. Platts," said Markham, glancing at the notes he had been making, "one or two more questions, and we won't trouble you further. Have you noticed anything in Mr. Benson's actions lately that might lead you to suspect that he was worried, or, let us say, in fear of anything happening to him?" "No, sir," the woman answered readily. "It looked like he was in special good humor for the last week or so." "I notice that most of the windows on this floor are barred. Was he particularly afraid of burglars, or of people breaking in?"
"Well, not exactly," was the hesitant reply. "But he did used to say as how the police were no good, begging your pardon, sir, and how a man in this city had to look out for himself if he didn't want to get held up."
Markham turned to Heath with a chuckle. "You might make a special note of that for your files, sergeant." Then to Mrs. Platts, "Do you know of anyone who had a grudge against Mr. Benson?"
"Not a soul, sir," the housekeeper answered emphatically. "He was a queer man in many ways, but everybody seemed to like him. He was all the time going to parties or giving parties. I just can't see why anybody'd want to kill him."
Markham looked over his notes again. "I don't think there's anything else for the present. How about it, sergeant? Anything further you want to ask?" Heath pondered a moment. "No, I can't think of anything more just now. But you, Mrs. Platts," he added, turning a cold glance on the woman, "will stay here in this house till you're given permission to leave. We'll want to question you later. But you're not to talk to anyone else, understand? Two of my men will be here for a while yet." Vance, during the interview, had been jotting down something on the fly-leaf of a small pocket address book, and as Heath was speaking, he tore out the page and handed it to Markham. Markham glanced at it frowningly and pursed his lips. Then, after a few moments' hesitation, he addressed himself again to the housekeeper. "You mentioned, Mrs. Platts, that Mr. Benson was liked by everyone. Did you yourself like him?" The woman shifted her eyes to her lap.
"Well, sir," she replied reluctantly, "I was only working for him, and I haven't got any complaint about the way he treated me." Despite her words, she gave the impression that she either disliked Benson extremely or greatly disapproved of him. Markham, however, did not push the point. "And by the way, Mrs. Platts," he said next, "did Mr. Benson keep any firearms about the house? For instance, do you know if he owned a revolver?" For the first time during the interview, the woman appeared agitated, even frightened.
"Yes, sir, I think he did," she admitted in an unsteady voice.
"Where did he keep it?"
The woman glanced up apprehensively and rolled her eyes slightly as if weighing the advisability of speaking frankly. Then she replied in a low voice,
"In that hidden drawer there in the center table. You use that little brass button to open it with."
Heath jumped up and pressed the button she had indicated. A tiny, shallow drawer shot out, and in it lay a Smith & Wesson 38 revolver with an inlaid pearl handle. He picked it up, broke the cartridge, and looked at the head of the cylinder.
"Full," he announced laconically.
An expression of tremendous relief spread over the woman's features, and she sighed audibly. Markham had risen and was looking at the revolver over Heath's shoulder.
"You'd better take charge of it, Sergeant," he said, "though I don't see exactly how it fits in with the case."
He resumed his seat, and glancing at the notation Vance had given him, turned again to the housekeeper.
"One more question, Mrs. Platts. You said Mr. Benson came home early and spent his time before dinner in this room. Did he have any callers during that time?"
I was watching the woman closely, and it seemed to me that she quickly compressed her lips. At any rate, she sat up a little straighter in her chair before answering.
"There wasn't no one, as far as I know."
"But surely you would have known if the bell rang," insisted Markham. "You would have answered the door, wouldn't you?"
"There wasn't no one," she repeated, with a trace of sullenness.
"And last night, did the doorbell ring at all after you had retired?"
"No, sir."
"You would have heard it, even if you'd been asleep?"
"Yes, sir. There's a bell just outside my door, the same as in the kitchen. It rings in both places. Mr. Benson had it fixed that way."
Markham thanked her and dismissed her. When she had gone, he looked at Vance questioningly. "What idea did you have in your mind when you handed me those questions?"
"I might have been a bit presumptuous, you know," said Vance. "But when the lady was extolling the deceased's popularity, I rather felt she was overdoing it a bit. There was an unconscious implication of antithesis in her eulogy, which suggested to me that she herself was not ardently enamoured of the gentleman."
"And what put the notion of firearms into your mind?"
"That query," explained Vance, "was a corollary of your own questions about barred windows and Benson's fear of burglars. If he was in a funk about housebreakers or enemies, he'd be likely to have weapons at hand. Eh, what?"
"Well, anyway, Mr. Vance," put in Heath, "your curiosity unearthed a nice little revolver that's probably never been used."
"By the by, Sergeant," returned Vance, ignoring the other's good-humoured sarcasm, "just what do you make of that nice little revolver?"
"Well, now," Heath replied, with ponderous facetiousness, "I deduct that Mr. Benson kept a pearl-handled Smith & Wesson in a secret drawer of his centre table."
"You don't say, really!" exclaimed Vance in mock admiration. "Positively illuminatin'."
Markham broke up this raillery. "Why did you want to know about visitors, Vance? There obviously hadn't been anyone here."
"Oh, just a whim of mine. I was assailed by an impulsive yearning to hear what La Platz would say."
Heath was studying Vance curiously. His first impressions of the man were being dispelled, and he had begun to suspect that beneath the other's casual and debonair exterior there was something of a more solid nature than he had at first imagined. He was not altogether satisfied with Vance's explanations to Markham, and seemed to be endeavouring to penetrate to his real reasons for supplementing the district attorney's interrogation of the housekeeper. Heath was astute, and he had the worldly man's ability to read people. But Vance, being different from the men with whom he usually came in contact, was an enigma to him. At length he relinquished his scrutiny and drew up his chair to the table with a spirited air. "And now, Mr. Markham," he said crisply, "we'd better outline our activities so as not to duplicate our efforts. The sooner I get my men started, the better." Markham assented readily. "The investigation is entirely up to you, Sergeant. I'm here to help wherever I'm needed."
"That's very kind of you, sir," Heath returned, "but it looks to me as though there'd be enough work for all parties. Suppose I get to work on running down the owner of the handbag, and send some men out scouting among Benson's nightlife cronies. I can pick up some names from the housekeeper, and they'll be a good starting point. And I'll get after that Cadillac, too. Then we ought to look into his lady friends. I guess he had enough of 'em."
"I may get something out of the major along that line," supplied Markham. "He'll tell me anything I want to know. And I can also look into Benson's business associates through the same channel." "I was going to suggest that you could do that better than I could," Heath rejoined. "We ought to run into something pretty quick that'll give us a line to go on. And I've got an idea that when we locate the lady he took to dinner last night and brought back here, we'll know a lot more than we do now."
"Or a lot less," murmured Vance.
Heath looked up quickly and grunted with an air of massive petulance. "Let me tell you something, Mr. Vance," he said, "since I understand you want to learn something about these affairs. When anything goes seriously wrong in this world, it's pretty safe to look for a woman in the case."
"Ah, yes," smiled Vance. "Cherchez la femme, an aged notion. Even the Romans labored under the superstition. They expressed it with dux femina facti."
"However they expressed it," retorted Heath, "they had the right idea, and don't let 'em tell you different." Again Markham diplomatically intervened. "That point will be settled very soon, I hope. And now, Sergeant, if you've nothing else to suggest, I'll be getting along. I told Major Benson I'd see him at lunchtime, and I may have some news for you by tonight."
"Right," assented Heath. "I'm going to stick around here a while and see if there's anything I overlooked. I'll arrange for a guard outside, and also for a man inside to keep an eye on the Platts woman. Then I'll see the reporters and let them in on the disappearing Cadillac and Mr. Vance's mysterious revolver in the secret drawer. I guess that ought to hold 'em. If I find out anything, I'll phone you."
When he had shaken hands with the district attorney, he turned to Vance. "Good-bye, sir," he said pleasantly, much to my surprise, and to Markham's too, I imagine. "I hope you learned something this morning."
"You'd be positively dumbfounded, Sergeant, at all I did learn," Vance answered carelessly.
Again I noted the look of shrewd scrutiny in Heath's eyes, but in a second it was gone.
"Well, I'm glad of that," was his perfunctory reply.
Markham, Vance, and I went out, and the patrolman on duty hailed a taxicab for us.
"So that's the way our lofty gendarmerie approaches the mysterious wherefores of criminal enterprise, eh?" mused Vance, as we started on our way across town. "Markham, old dear, how do those robust lads ever succeed in running down a culprit?"
"You have witnessed only the barest preliminaries," Markham explained. "There are certain things that must be done as a matter of routine, ex abundantia cautelae, as we lawyers say."
"But my word, such technique!" sighed Vance.
"Ah, well, quantum est in rubis inan, as we laymen say."
"You don't think much of Heath's capacity, I know." Markham's voice was patient. "But he's a clever man, and one that it's very easy to underestimate."
"I dare say," murmured Vance.
"Anyway, I'm deuced grateful to you and all that for letting me behold the solemn proceedings. I've been vastly amused, even if not uplifted. Your official Aesculapius rather appealed to me, you know. Such a brisk, unemotional chap, and utterly unimpressed with the corpse. He really should have taken up crime in a serious way, instead of studying medicine."
Markham lapsed into gloomy silence and sat looking out of the window in troubled meditation until we reached Vance's house. "I don't like the look of things," he remarked as we drew up to the curb. "I have a curious feeling about this case." Vance regarded him a moment from the corner of his eye.
"See here, Markham," he said with unwonted seriousness, "haven't you any idea who shot Benson?"
Markham forced a faint smile.
"I wish I had. Crimes of willful murder are not so easily solved, and this case strikes me as a particularly complex one."
"Fancy now," said Vance, as he stepped out of the machine, "and I thought it extraordinarily simple."
End of chapter 4